There are certain films which you can, certain kind of maybe very naturalistic films that you can do with just good actors who may not have, what, for want of a better word, one calls star quality. Star quality is that bigger than life thing that fills the screen. It's that thing that makes one feel like a child. I mean, it's me anyway, I'm talking from personal experience. There were a lot of people who had it in the 40s, a lot of people had it in the 50s, certainly a lot of people had it in the 30s. Undoubtedly less today, some but fewer. And when you're dealing with this kind of the romantic melodrama, where you're dealing with boldly sketched characters, you know, I call Rollover in certain ways a cautionary fable, and it requires, and it requires this, what I call the ability to fill a screen, and it has something to do with being a good actor, but a lot of good actors don't have it. It has a lot to do with being a movie star, and it has to do with holding an audience's attention in a certain way, in a certain kind of hypnotic quality. Jane certainly has it. I felt the man needed it, and needed a man who had that too, and I feel Chris has that. Although Chris has been a leading man in many ways, more than a star, he's been a big leading man. I found, just in working with him, that he has that certain kind of magnetism that fills the screen. There's, and this film needs it. It's on the way Hitchcock films do. If you read the Hitchcock Truffaut book, there were several films he did where he didn't have what he considered major stars, and where he settled for somebody he felt didn't have that quality. And he felt the films never worked the way they should have worked. Because when you're dealing with melodrama, with complicated plots, you have to sketch your characters in boldly. You need characters the audience can immediately identify with. It's, and in that way, this film has the problems, and I find the fascinating problems, of a Hitchcock picture in that way.
And it's more than a matter of really just physical attractiveness?
Yeah, because I think a lot of physically attractive people who are not memorable. There are certain people one talks to in life who are bigger in life than they are on the screen, and there are some people it's vice versa. It's, I've never been totally sure what it was that this. There are directors who say about some actors, the camera loves them. It's another way of putting it. That something happens between the camera and them, and when you put that face up on a screen that big, they become these huge dream figures. And other people, you put them up on the screen that big, and it doesn't happen. It's just there, they kind of sit, and they look rather smaller for it. And this film is, in that way, part of that kind of motion picture tradition. Now, I like to use melodrama for different ends. This is a film made with a very bravura theatrical style, set up in the very beginning. When you come into that, while it's, the banking world has dealt with reality, and I spent a great deal of time doing a great deal of research on that, and we had technical advisors, and I am fascinated by worlds of work, as I was in all the presidents, I'm fascinated by the world of journalism, I was fascinated by the world of banking. But that's only one segment of this film. It exists within a very theatrical to viewer story. To get that, I try to set the style immediately. It's like an overture at the beginning, you know, when the lights come on one in that room. The very fact that it's a world of numbers, is a theatrical concept, that you were surrounded by numbers and no windows. Now, I got that idea from reality. I mean, I went to one trading room, because I visited trading rooms all over New York. I went to one trading room, and they had projections of numbers on the wall, and suddenly it made that whole room come alive and make it a very specific place. But I wanted to say this is a theatrical piece in that way. It's not a documentary.
And there's that quality about Hume Cronyn where we are really never permitted to see him as a villain. He has his reasons.
He has his
motivations.
Actually, everybody has their reasons.
Right.
Do you know? I mean, in one line, the oil people have their reasons when they said, "What happens if we get stuck? If the economy falls apart and we're left with the paper money, the oil runs out, and we're left with paper money, it's worthless. That's all we have." There's maybe Sal is the closest to a villain in the piece, since he's the kind of hired hand who does the dirty work. But Hume is not. No, Hume's interesting. Hume's father was a banker, and his grandfather was a banker. So he loved the idea of playing a banker because his father always wanted to be a banker. And then he went off and became an actor. He said, "My father, you know, at least I'm fulfilling my father's wish to be a banker for a few months."
He hasn't done that many films. Did you get on to him right away with this character?
He was one of the people on the top of the list. Uh-huh. I'd worked with Hume once before in Parallax View. He played a newspaper editor. And I love Hume. He has, again, in his own way, Hume has a mythic quality. He represents that kind of man, you know.
I wish I'd seen him more over the years.
I do too. But he puts what happened if he went to stage. You know, Jesse and they went.
What was the reference to Camping Fan? Was that an inside joke?
Well, the only reason for it is that everybody's. Well, no, it really wasn't. Actor David Shaver, the screenwriter, put that in, and he didn't do all the President's Men. But the minute you mention anybody becoming chairman of the board of a company or a widow taking over a company, people always say, "Well, look, Catherine Graham did it. She became, her husband
I thought
died."
Joan Crawford initially.
There's a mixed. I would say in prototypes, you could say there's a mixture thereof. Yes, I mean the idea of she didn't take over Pepsi Cola, but she was an ex movie star whose husband died. So there's that kind of background.
A lot of directors have what they consider signature shots, and you've certainly demonstrated that you probably have one favorite, at least in this particular film. Your opening shot of a 180-degree pan stationary, and then you had a double 180-degree pan at the conclusion, showing the equipment unshrouded and then shrouded.
That's my favorite shot. And it's, I don't like tour de force shots for their own sake, unless they boldly tell a story. And to show the death of an old world, you know, and then at the end, the two of them beginning, making first efforts toward a new. But to do it visually in one shot, I mean, that was something I wanted to find a way to do. And you open with that trading room, and then a trading room that was kind of a microcosm of the monetary trading banking world for the film. And you see that room so alive and so full of activity. And it's something I wanted, a motion picture way of showing everything just coming to a halt. So I said to Pepe Rotuno, I wanted a very, this sounds very pretentious, and I swore I wouldn't say it, except in my notebooks to myself, but I'll say it. I mean, I felt there's a kind of American Baroque style about this film. So you're dealing with people who live in a very, in quotation marks, glamorous world. People live in a world at the top. There's a visual comment in almost every scene in this film. They're always behind glass, like Hume Cronin, they're always behind glass in cars and way on top of the world or in rooms cut off from the world. You never see the people in the real world except in that escalator going down.
And Cronin always seems rather isolated with people surrounding him.
Right, exactly. And he's always in these quiet places, these areas, and you look out and there he is, and there's the world beneath him. There's those huge buildings, all that power. And then suddenly at the end, in the suicide scene, those voices pour in, the world suddenly pours in, you know, those screaming crowds where it's never been allowed in. These people are insulated, that there are people who are dealing with economic problems as abstract numbers. They're not.
Am I correct in assuming that Rotuno's experience with Visconti and Fellini, he delighted in that kind of
thing? Delighted in that kind of thing. He's wonderful. And I said to him, I showed him some Xeroxes of pictures that we'd taken of looking for locations. And color Xeroxes have an odd quality. Well, it becomes rather contrasty and it's a hard edge to it. And I said, I want that quality in this film. I want that hard edge. I don't want to sentimentalize, you know, make it lyricize Life of the Rich. It's glamorous, but with a hard, cool edge to it. He's absolutely wonderful. When I came to him about talking about the 360 at the end, and I said, I don't see how we can do it live. What we'll have to do is do one shot with everybody in it, and then another shot with the shrouds on. And the shrouds came. I walked into the studio one morning, and they hadn't early in the shooting the picture, and they hadn't taken the shrouds off the. And I came in, and there it was. And I said, "That's the last image of this room." Because it's going to be true. And when the camera moved around, I said to him, obviously we can't do it live. We'll have to do it. And he said, no, the only way to do it is live. So he said, it'll have much more immediacy. Of course, he was right. I said, if you can do it, terrific. I'd much rather do it that way. So we had a time, all that was done while the camera was going around.
Putting the shrouds on.
People disappearing off the set.
And altering the lighting, too.
And a lighting cue's changing.
Yeah.
So there are three things happening at the same time. People having to get off the set, lighting cues having to change, and shrouds being thrown on by stagehands at the same time. And it all had to be timed the minute the camera left something. So that there's... But in melodrama, there's a certain kind of melodrama. There's a kind of magical quality to me. Hi, Roger. And I wanted that in that shot. I wanted that sense of magic. Everything seems to be here, and everything's in place, and suddenly nothing's in place. Everything's gone. It can disappear that quickly. We live in a world where it can just all just change in front of your eyes, and suddenly it's all gone. And what all seemed so real and so alive and so there and so present, suddenly there it is, and it's just shrouded, and it's gone. And the challenge is to do it in the camera, for me, and in terms of this style of this film, which is, again, is a high theatrical style, not naturalistic.
They used to say, never make a film about baseball, because baseball films, they said, never made a film about the film, the subject matter you chose, to me, it's highly special. Be very careful there. I don't begin to understand the finer intricacies of
economics. I have a general knowledge of them, and I was able to follow your film on a certain superficial level. And I think I know more about economy than the average American does. Did you give some thought to the possibility that you were maybe doing this film for a more sophisticated audience, a general movie audience?
No, I wanted to do it for a general movie audience, and we took the film out to San Jose last Saturday, and there was a young audience, and they obviously followed the story. And there were cards that said, I followed it, I wonder if other people would be able to follow it. It's like, I'm the only genius in the house. There's a fine line that we were balancing on. And one is that the audience must know enough to follow the story. And we tried from the very beginning of the film, and I know that there's a confusion at the beginning, but we're trying to initiate them into that banking world, and when you come back to it, it won't seem so strange. At the same time that they have to know enough to follow the story, and it's really the center of the story can put into what Hitchcock would call a MacGuffin, which is a number 21214. If they can start to follow that and keep following that number, that's all they have to follow nothing else, and then find out what that number means and why there's a conspiracy about it. If they can follow that, they have the melodrama. The picture makes sense to them. They have a curiosity about the mystery will work, and the suspense will work for them, which is what I found seemed to happen. The other area that was giving an authenticity to the banking world. Now, we had this technical advisor, this man who used to be head trader for Northern Guarantee Trust. And I wanted that room to have an authenticity. As long as there were throwaway lines and you didn't have to understand them, I found it going into those rooms. There's something exciting about going to a room into another world that you don't belong to. That's what some people feel about movie sets, I think. And seeing that shorthand where they talk, kind of, yes, it's gobbledygook to us, it all works, and they're communicating in some way in this very fast pace and this strange language, and they're communicating all over the world. And I found myself fascinated by the authenticity of that without understanding what was going on. And I thought, to have that authenticity in back, as long as the audience doesn't need that to follow the plot, and that's was what interested me. That was the fine line I was doing. Give them enough information to be able to follow the plot. At the same time, to give them some look into what that world is like, because it is a very interesting world.
You said it's shorthand, but I mean, are they really that noisy?
Yes.
How do they ever distinguish?
They're that noisy, and very few of them over 40. They burn out. They burn out.
I mean, they're on the phone, but other people are.
Well, they're like traffic controllers.
They're like traffic. Yeah. And they burn out fast. Most of them in their 20s. Early 30s, I mean, you see these baby faces there, and they're handling, you know, millions and millions of dollars a day, making transactions. And as a matter of fact, I mean, when I went around, I was at Salomon Brothers, and the man was taking me around, and he just said, you'd never find anybody your age, they'll be burned out long before your age. He said, and also machines have changed, all the machines they're using, all the charts they're looking at. And it's
Do they go into other areas? They go into other areas of binding?
They could, yes, they go into easier areas usually. Yes. Fine, thanks. Exactly.
So great to see some glamour in a film again. The first shot of her is startling because I don't think we've seen her this way for a long time.
I wanted to immediately set her up as another.
Everything. And it was kind of nice, you know, to see her walking down the stairway in a white satin gown. You know, I think, wow, this is, looks a little like we remember. And I think you have that feeling in your
family. Well, Jane has that quality. I mean, yeah. I once said about Jane, when I was doing Clute, that she's one of the only American actresses of her generation who could play a prostitute, play the wife of a famous industrialist and be a perfect wife for him. I was the head of IBM at that time, and really go through a range of our society. She has that. Plus, she has that star quality. But I wanted the glamour is a very important part of this film. It is about
the world.
Of this world. And I set up that party at the Museum of Natural History because how do you show the power of this world?
I thought it was in front of the Metropolitan Opera. I couldn't figure
it out. No, it was a Museum of Natural History. And how do you set up the
later party? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that one was Vivian Beaumont, actually.
Beaumont, that's right.
But in setting up, how do you show the power of that world? And there's a bizarreness about it. There's a bizarreness about money in a certain social strata. The whales, and there they are, it's like they're underwater, and it's like they've taken over the bottom of the sea.
Yeah.
Now, that came because I went to a party in that room about a year and a half ago. And I thought, it says it.
A number of directors have been known as staircase specialists in the past for certain scenes in their films, like Hitchcock, a number of his movies, and, of course, probably the most memorable, Fleming in Gone with the Wind. You seem to have a lot of fun and get the best possible execution on your staircase scene. How did you approach that?
Well, again, I felt I wanted mythic movie characters. I wanted these are people who live on the top. And I wanted that attraction. What I was looking for were two people who were busy being in control of their own lives all the time. They are game players. They are manipulators. They're masters at it. And at some moment in their own love story, at some moment they just lose in the attraction. Something just takes over. It's the most spontaneous thing in their lives. And it just happens. And the whole idea for me of two people going out to a dinner party, and you're ready to go out to a dinner party, and you see, and that moment happens, and it just happens like that, it excited me on some erotic, romantic level. And it also dramatized what I wanted to dramatize. These are people who are on the way for a plan. They never violate those things about being on time to set a plan in motion or to meet this kind of person to get that kind of money to dinner party. And I wanted to do it in a very theatrical way, in a very cinematic way. And I wanted to do it, yes, this is a movie in that way. Jane, and I feel Chris has it too, of people who have a certain star quality that goes back to the classic Hollywood period. And yes, there were certain echoes of that kind of glamour in this film.
I wanted
that for this film.
Yeah, that scene as well.
Harder Edge.
A couple others were, to me, particularly reminiscent of Gone with the Wind.
Well, the staircase scene.
That one certainly. But
I was not unaware that a few people like Mr. Fleming had been up the staircase before me.
if it was just one, I wouldn't accuse you of wanting to pay a homage. But I mean, there seemed to be two or three maybe there. Christopherson standing, kind of arms on his hips in the big stair in the.
Well, but that's doing something else. That's drama. You mean on the balcony?
Oh, apartment.
No, his apartment.
No,
his apartment.
Because
that's that's dramatizing paranoia.
Yeah, no.
I was trying to do all that without her saying a word. Show how she begins to see him as. And again, it's these two people who fall in love, but they don't really have she can never really have a trust, which is set up on the airplane. We attempt to, which is, I still don't think I trust you now.
I sort of thought that was part of the excitement of their being
yes,
together.
Yes.
The danger of their.
Yes, 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 there is. Yes, there is. And I think for a man like that, meeting a woman like that, who's his equal in that level. But in the scene of the staircases, that shot was, that whole scene is shot totally subjectively. And it's her looking up and suddenly looking at that man, and he shot as could this man be really in this conspiracy? Could he have something to do with the killing of my husband? And the shot in the bed. It's all subjective from her point of view. And the problem of that was, for me, that interested me, was that in no way could you dramatize that with words, because there's nobody she would talk to. The minute she has somebody to talk to, it just lessens everything. So it has to all be done with the camera. And couldn't have been done for me the way I wanted it without that set. And that set came out of looking for locations. And I said, actually, it was a real location. It was a real apartment. It was really, it wasn't a bedroom. It was a living room and dining room of an apartment. And at that point, I love looking for locations. Love reality, because like it just always gives you ideas. I mean, looking at those foreign, and I said, at that point, it's the first time a scene can work for me, because she goes down and she looks up there. The whole thing of her, that bed being downstairs and hearing on the phone over there, it just, that people being on two different levels at that point. It all, suddenly I thought the camera can, well, and I had Rotuno, who knows, the minute you say that to him. Interesting thing with Pepe, who was, I'll apologize for his English all the time, and the only times we ever had troubles understanding each other when we talked about life, when we talked about the film, he never misunderstood for a second, nor did he forget anything.
This thing about locations, too, what about the location, the house of Fuster? I mean, that's what he wants. That's his power.
Yes, circle. I wanted just that. Also, house, that house, you know, is the only middle-class, ordinary life. Everything else in this huge scale are people living in a totally different scale. And the only bourgeois life you see of ordinary people in this film is Fuster's house. And then I saw a print last week, and his house was cold. It looked like the rest of the film. I said, I wanted some.
The red wall.
Yeah, and that's a real house. That's a house in Levittown. And every one of those decorations are by those owners, God bless them, were proud of everything in that house. And it has that feeling about it. I mean, I got to watch me, because I went in there and wanted us to for 5 days in that house, you know, because I saw all these little details. I wasn't foolish, and I didn't. But it's the only, it was, I felt early on in this picture I had to give something against which this Baroque world of people, something to give it a sense of scale, a reminder of what the real world is like. Otherwise, you start taking it for granted. And going from the museum, there is a certain grotesqueness about some of the glamour in this film that interests me. Well, better interests me since I spent a year and a half at it. But I mean, at least that we were reaching for. And that hard edge to it. And then you come into that, it's the only family you see. And Clue, too, there was only one family scene.
It's great when you go down to Dunkin' Donuts. I mean,
The Dunkin' Donuts is almost
a shot.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah. But it has almost a kind of pop art quality about it, that shot. Right. Anyway, that thing. And that's just the real Dunkin' Donuts. But it's, there's a certain kind of pop images about a certain part of this film for me. I mean, in the shooting of this film, while we worked very hard at authenticity in that trading room. And those actors were studying, and Ron in particular, who plays Hovey, who has a great sense of authenticity. But the film itself never saw as naturalistic. It always, that's what interests me about melodrama. It gives you a chance to do visual storytelling, subjective storytelling, and to use the camera in a way that fascinates me, especially dealing with this kind of subject material. And it is a myth. It is a fable. And the screen is wonderful for that kind of thing. And that's why I said, yes, I wanted movie stars who were not just actors, but who have that other quality. So that.
You weren't worrying about undermining the seriousness?
It's always the danger of that. It's always the danger of that, and I expect that somebody's going to say that. I thought a lot about that. It is a fable. It is a myth. It is full of bigger-than-life characters in that way. And yet, there's a whole tradition of tales like that being told with people like that, that kind of style. And while it's not naturalistic, the basis of characters, of the kind of characters that Chris and Jane play, there's certainly plenty I know in reality. And maybe that part of the museum seems rather grotesque. I went to a real part of the Museum of Natural History. I suddenly realized that what these people take for granted, you know, there is, for me, a certain grotesqueness in that certain world at the top. And people also play roles in it like that.
I was going to say, it is a world of filmmaking after all.
Yes, and they have people who have a sense of their own glamour. And
Lee is not an ex-movie star. She's
very much so. I mean, you go into the social world, go and buy W and see the woman posing in it. you know, out in the newsstand here. And they'll be posing on staircases in white satin gowns, and when they make an entrance for that man, I trimmed that scene last week because it was longer, the staircase, and it made, and there was a scene in the office right before that with Chris, which after he says, "We have nothing to hide, do we?" And it went on longer, and it made Jane look like she was reaching to be more seductive than she really had intended to be. So I cut into it, and now when she starts to walk, she never stops walking. It just happens. But at the same time, she is a woman. She's an ex-movie star who always knows how she looks. When I talked about her house, and that's a real house. It's not redecorated. It's owned by the Philippine government. And it's empty, and they use it for housing exhibitions. And Mrs. Marcos has thought of taking it over as a residence when she's in New York for 2 days out of the year, but she hasn't yet. So we got a chance to rent it. But when I talked with George Jenkins about it, and when I talked with Pepe, I said, it's the one place where I've talked about a hard edge for this picture, where I want it to be a light that's attractive to her. I want a softness. This is a woman who is a movie star, who knows how she looks, who's designed this home as a background for herself. And she manipulates in that way, and she's wonderful at it. And, and you should be able to enjoy it, because when you're in the hands of somebody like that, I know some people like that, and they do it so wonderfully that it's just a delight to, you know, you walk in and you know that they've arranged themselves and they've done the whole thing, and you just know you're in the hands of the master. And I said, I want that. I mean, when that man comes there to that house, that woman is in that position, and she's in that room, and there's that light that's right for her. That's her bailiwick, because her glamour is one of the things she has to use. So that there is a certain deliberate theatricality about it. Yes, there is. I don't think that in its sense is dishonest.
What always attracts so many of your films about conspiracy? Where attractive foreground people are threatened by half-understood background forces that may or may not be their own paranoia.
Well, in this case, there was a scene that says it's not their own paranoia.
But it isn't their paranoia, but...
But their paranoia is, it is about people who distress somewhere, and then they distress come true. Yeah.
But also they find vast, shadowy, evil things unfolding that
yes,
they didn't think existed in the world that they lived in. That would probably describe four or five of your films.
Yeah, it would. It would. And very different films, but it would.
I think
even All the President's Men, and even All the President's Men, because it's what journalism is about, too, on a totally different level. Clued on another level, it's a girl that goes into the trying to find out, well, subtle and different. It obviously appeals to me on some unconscious level, and there's a great attraction. I think we live in a world where most of our paranoid fantasies have come true. And I think that's absolutely the truth of it. I mean, my next picture is Sophie's Choice, and it deals with a woman who's been through the Holocaust. Now, I have been running... Nobody could have created Hitler in their fantasy and believed it could be true. And what we've been going on, what's been going on here in the last 20 years... I guess there is something in me that I was born. I'm an American middle class Jew. My father came over from Poland. I was born with a total belief in the American dream, which I really still have with all my paranoia. And blessed to be here, and knowing I was alive because I was in America. You know, my father reminded me of that. Went through the Depression as a small child, and while he had started, he was very poor to begin with. He was comfortable enough, middle class enough, that I never worried about money, I never worried about starving. I believed that I would live like Candide in the best of all possible world. And we now live in a world where within that world, we just keep seeing... I guess I'm always surprised by evil, Roger. And that's the kind of American innocence. You know, there is a continual loss of innocence. You can start back with me as a producer with To Kill a Mockingbird, which is the story of a loss of innocence for those children, their first contact with evil. And I guess that has an ending unconscious vitality for me. Now, I don't go running around saying, I'll do this picture because of that. You know, you don't. But when you say that, it rings a bell, and I say, of course, he's absolutely right. Best to forget about it and just go and do it with unconscious, but it's absolutely true.
Also, it just makes for a good story, too, doesn't it?
It makes for a good story, but I think it makes for a story that's... It's been appropriate in all times, but particularly appropriate this time. And what's interesting is the innocent here, the innocence, what fascinated me, are very sophisticated people who believe they know the world and can deal with the world and control the world, and they're on top. They're the manipulators, and then they find out they're being manipulated. That's what fascinated me about this. This is a melodrama story. Usually it's the innocent, but you know, these are two people who are masters of manipulation, and then they find they're being manipulated from on top.
Have you cast Sophie's Choice?
Yeah, Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep. Who plays the boy?
Peter McNichol, who's in Crimes of the Heart.
Is that Christie's brother?
No, no relation.
Peter McNichol?
Yeah, but he's in the playbook Crimes of the Heart. I start filming the beginning of February.
So he's leaving.
He leaves the play in February, or maybe the middle of February.
Who's Sophie's brother?
Kevin Kline.
Oh, yeah.
Who was in Pirates of Penzance. You see, I do like, to some point, at least I think I like doing different kinds of films. It doesn't look to be that different, I guess. But I feel that in Sophie, the whole thing is it's a mystery of character. You go right down into the character. This was much more like the problems of Hitchcock, setting up bold mythic characters to begin with and then letting them go across that surface. Because if you start... It was the opposite problems for me, in a way. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this film. Plus, it was an attempt to try to amalgamate, you know, win, lose, or draw. And I am attracted to strange combinations and strange brews and strange stews. Of a mixture of authenticity in a world of banking, in this kind of Baroque plot, this Baroque film done in this kind of Baroque visual style, culminating in that 360 at the end.
I want to ask you about that scene in the desert. Her reaction, or their reaction to her, was part of that the Arabian custom or feeling about women joining them? Did they resent her a little bit? They looked at her, they didn't say anything.
She was odd. She's odd because to have a woman in on business is odd.
Yeah.
But all I was trying to do there, and one of the things I liked about the scene was this is a woman who always seems to be in command. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see her uncomfortable. It's nice to see, like all of us, in the act of traveling in civilization, and suddenly she's looking and she's smiling and she's a little it's discomforted. She's out of her element. And
because women have no power there, right? Women have no
authority. Women have no power, and it's very unusual to be.
Women need estrogen.
Pardon me.
Women usually need estrogen.
Yes. Yes.
What made you choose the bazaar in Marrakesh?
Well, because we couldn't get into. We couldn't get into Saudi Arabia.
You mentioned that you had done some trimming last week. Was that the last of any trimming you may be doing on this picture? Are we seeing it in its final?
The print is not color corrected. I felt it was what you saw last night. I saw in the afternoon. I thought it was rather blue and all that, but it's basically the picture.
After the staircase scene, you were talking about Hitchcock.
And another thing I recall Hitchcock saying once in an interview was that every scene must have a direct purpose in telling
That's
the
right.
story. And right after the staircase scene, we see them arriving at the dinner.
That's right.
And it's just this little scene where Chris is taking off her coat, and he rubs her cheek with his thumb. And then they go into
but
the dinner.
But that's the end of the staircase. Instead of ending on the... Oh, right, for want of a better word, Victor Fleming in his arms. By the way, she was much more willing than Scarlett at that point. It was a rather different mood.
Well, did she have one dress for the seduction and the other to go out?
My indication.
Yes, I would have liked
that too. Yes. We can thank Annie Roth for that too, but it's actually true. But beyond that, also, the indication was that the dress did get a bit mush.
That's right.
You know, and I also like doing that kind of thing where you don't see anything. Which is, by the part of, in quotation marks, old-fashioned Hollywood, which I found sex much more glamorous, you know, than in that way. And it's again, there's a magic in this film. It's like the magic of the 360. It's suddenly, boom, they're going up the staircase, and then the next shot, there they are, and they're coming in, and they've made love, and there she is in another dress, and it's,
What was the funny thing that they said?
He says we got caught in traffic. So for a moment, I didn't think I'd get there myself.
Yeah.
It's a very short scene, but Sal is brought back into it again. Fenway brought back into it again. Emery's brought back into it again. Again, I was trying to show the world. This world is a world of business. It's also a world of parties. And again, I was trying to show that dinner party in sense. And that sense of, and there's a nice character moment for me in that scene for Emery. It's light, but it's that, you know, besides progressing the story, when they look at each other, the lovers, you know, and the music plays again as an echo of what there was. While everything's going on the table, they're playing each other. That it ends on Emery looking, and that man, like any really good banker, he just knows exactly what's going on. There's that kind of perception. And it also humanizes them.
Could we talk for a second about Daisy Clover? Do you mind talking about it? I'm here to answer questions.
I look back on this probably one of your best films.
I produced it recently on TV,
and I loved it even more.
It was terribly bad when it came out.
Yeah, but I thought it was about 10 years ahead of time. I think if it had been done by a foreigner, a Frenchman, probably would have gotten much better reception.
I don't know, about 10 years ago, I had a little lecture at the British Film Institute, and they would have you waiting back, and they introduced you. One of the more embarrassing moments, they said, and they gave a list of my credits and all that, or discredits, whatever you want to call them. And they said, and here he is, Alan Pakula. And I started to walk down the aisle, as they told me to do, to go up on the stage. And they started playing "You're Gonna Hear From Me." Move over stars and give me some sky. This voice comes out on the loudspeaker. I'm walking up there, like Natalie Wood. There are a lot of things about that picture I found very interesting. I don't want to go into a long discussion of that picture now.
They showed it recently, and I saw it again.
But it was terrible the first time,
and I really
haven't seen it long.
Grows on it really.
It gets better.
Yeah. Well, which of your films are you the most satisfied with, the happiest one?
It's the ones I don't have favorites in that way, because I've never done a film where there was something that I didn't like, and I've never done a film where there was something that I didn't dislike. And I found that if a film was a success, you can do some of your worst work in the film and it won't be seen. And if the film is a failure, you can do some of your best work in it and it doesn't matter, it won't be seen. So, I mean, it's... I think it would be easier for me to make a compilation of my favorite sequences in films I've done rather than...
Do you personally like Daisy Clover? Today, do you stand by it?
Yeah, but I haven't seen it in 10 or 15 years. I thought it was an interesting, eccentric film. I thought, off the record, that now it's so many years later, one can say this. I felt the Natalie, whom I love, was odd casting in a way. In that Natalie, one of Natalie's wonderful qualities is that she's a girl next door, that she fits in, she blends in, she has a wonderful comedic quality of blending into where she is. And the essence of that part of Daisy Clover really was like a Lautrec character, something that was different and unlike anything else in the world, and that just got pulled and used. That was, and then Natalie played it, but I mean, it's fine. It's what a young Streisand Minnelli have today. Yep. You know what I mean? That kind of thing that comes on, and it's unlike anybody else in the world coming on. And then it's packaged and put into a thing where it's going to be used and somewhat destroyed.
And while we're talking about other films, it seems like there's some striking parallels between this and Comes a Horseman.
I don't see that.
Because of Jane Fonda. She is assuming a self-reliant position. She's struggling for, you know, to retain her own kind of power. And then you have the other ranch, which you see a kind of a, well, conspiratorial element almost taking over, the business about spheres of power, the staircases with Robards. I see some parallels there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a totally rural film in a way, and this is a totally urban film.
True.
Which is a major difference. This is... well, many differences. Women, I know what you, the idea of a man and woman working together as equals, which is something I find very appealing, is in both films. That is in both films. And also they both, all the President's Man too, have to deal with worlds of work too, you know, exploring worlds of work, whether it be ranching or journalism or bank. There's always that within the film, within the context of the film. There's that.
Clearly you spend a lot of, you give a lot of thought to every aspect of your film, right down to the paintings that go on the wall.
Yeah.
Yet the American film-going public hasn't particularly been noted recently for its discerning intelligence and what it flocks to see. Are you, you find yourself perhaps out of step with what a big audience wants to see?
Why don't you ask me that next year?
They flock to see your research.
I think the Starting Over did very well. And I did it... I can only do films I want to see. I certainly didn't flock to see Comes a Horseman.
I'm sorry.
People always say, well, why did you choose to do that film? Roger made an interesting point about, you know, consistency of thematic thing. As a matter of fact, I'm going to think about that tonight. I know that. But finally, when they said, why did you choose to do that film? And the first reason is because I wanted to see it. The child in me wanted to see that film. Wanted to see it enough. I wanted to see it enough for like a year and a half or 2 years or however long it's going to take. And to work on that. That's my... My wife does the New York Times crossword puzzle. I make movies. You know, it's my fascination. It's the obsession. So it's got to be something that appeals to some unconscious part of me that has that kind of vitality for me. So, and then you only hope, you try to, you know, that there are enough people who have similar tastes. But am I out of, and you try to examine yourself against the public as much as you can and say, wait a minute, is this something so esoteric on my part? But, in terms of this film, Love and Money, I don't think are particularly esoteric, you know, even though that points of banking are maybe.
I didn't mean particularly whether you are out of touch in terms of whether your films were a financial success, but that you pay a whole lot of attention to the sort of detail that doesn't mean anything to the public.
Yeah, but it does. They may not mean it intellectually, consciously, but the Lichtenstein and the paintings like that on her the walls of that hallway somewhere characterize it. And they may not know it, but it gives a very specific sense of, for me anyway, of a woman, I mean, this is all thrown away when I discuss it, a woman who was a movie star, probably raised herself up by her own bootstraps, but didn't have the education, has now become, as you see her in the museum, the perfect social lady. First you see her as the social lady and rather conservative, and who's learned how to collect art and be surrounded by very sophisticated art. That is, you know, we had long talks about what kind of paintings would she have. I could have made it into kind of Palm Beach hostess, but she gravitated to a certain kind of safe 18th century painting and wanted that kind of establishment thing. And I felt, no, this woman of daring, this woman of boldness, this is a woman with a very quick mind. Now, with Chris, I surrounded him with Western art, with Remingtons and all of that. There was a basis for that. There was one of the major bankers, Citibank, from the West, is a rancher. And I also, so I'm not trying to say that Chris didn't come from the West. There were bankers that come from the West and use that, but I think when you show somebody's home, you are characterizing that person. And somewhere the audience, and how that person dresses, you're doing all of that. And somewhere where the audience may not intellectually, I don't care if they know what painted that or what, but somewhere, for me, it's there's something more whole in the texture. Also, that kind of texture interests me. And... you dare not get bored while you're making a film. Just dare not. I mean, it's...
Yours may be the first film that lists the paintings and the artists. I don't think I've ever seen that before in credit.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I looked at them the first time the other day, and I said, how could I have made this film without Boy with Fish?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.